Hello, and welcome to Rabble Radio. It's Friday, June 10, 2022. I'm your host, Breanne Doyle. Thanks so much for tuning in. Rabble's got its finger on the beat of the issues that matter to you. If you're curious about the latest news in Canadian politics, labor, environment, or social justice, you've come to the right place to find the stories that matter to you, free of corporate influence. This week on Rabble Radio, we feature a segment from our latest Off the Hill political panel. This month's theme, Hot Summer in the West. The Alberta political scene is in upheaval with the departure of the current disgraced premier, and the federal conservative leadership race is becoming increasingly vitriolic. Amid this time of turbulence, what can we expect to see unfold in Alberta and in Ottawa, and what will the impact be on the political scene overall? Our latest panel was made up by special guests Rachel Snow, David Kleimenhage, Chuka Ejekam, Carl Narenberg, and co-hosted by Robin Brown and Libby Davies. We'd like to share a small segment of that panel with you all today. Take a listen.
So I'm going to begin with David, and I want to get your take on what it means for Albertans and Canadians overall to see the departure of Jason Kenney. Is it really a political shift or new faces, same old game?
Well, that's a difficult question to answer because there are elements of all three possibilities that you gave that are true. It's certainly the fact that Mr. Kenney was really pushed out of office by opponents in his own party, more on the right than on the left, indicates that there is a shift going on here, at least a shift within the United Conservative Party. Whether it means a lot in terms of how Alberta will vote in the next election, which is less than a year from now, if we abide by the fixed election date that the UCP put in place, when they modified Alison Redford's legislation that had a fixed election period of 3 months. So, you know, how significant the change is depends on a whole bunch of factors. There's a lot of people campaigning to replace Mr. Kenney. Some of them are official candidates now, some of them are not. I thought, you know, when I started thinking about this and I sat down here to get my mind in the right space for this conversation, I said, well, I'm going to note down all the names on a piece of paper. Well, now the page is full with people that were rumored to be in and are out, or people that are possibly going to be in but haven't actually formally declared themselves yet. So it's hard to say just how significant this is going to be. But my best guess is that we'll see either even a further rightward shift on the part of the UCP, or a steady as she goes, much more of the same, but with a milder figurehead at the top. I think the two leading candidates, I'm not bold enough to declare one of them a front runner, but are Brian Jean, the former leader of the Wild Rose Party, and Travis Taves. And Mr. Taves is I think that ideologically he's very close to Kenney, although he claims that he's not a career politician, and actually up to now that would appear to be true. But if he is not a career politician, he's a non-career politician in a position to become one if he becomes the leader of the party.
I think the way you've laid it out, it's similar to what's going on at the national level, where the various candidates some of them are trying to sort of cater to a base, and it's moving the party to a much sharper, harsher right. Others are maybe more sort of looking to a more sort of mainstream kind of conservatism. And I just wonder in Alberta whether your sense of the campaign to oust Kenney that came from so many ridings and riding presidents, and then of course the membership vote, whether it was more a dissatisfaction with Kenney personally, or whether it does signal some kind of bigger shift in terms of conservative politics.
Well, there's no question that there was an element in Alberta who saw Jason Kenney as too mainstream, and you'll see on social media real extreme comments about him. You know, he's practically in Trudeau's pocket. Statements like that. So there's no question that there was an element in the UCP base that was pushing him that way. But there were also you know, lingering red Tories and pretty moderate conservatives in the party who are not necessarily unhappy with conservatism or old style conservatism or with other potential candidates, but found Kenny very difficult. He seemed to have a knack to and managed to alienate almost everybody in the province, not just in the party, over the course of 3 years. But the style of the Kenny government has been so appalling to many people who I think, including people in his own cabinet, let alone his own caucus, for the kind of highly aggressive social media tactics used by his political advisors, the very personal tone it takes on whenever anyone questions him. So he created conditions and encouraged a kind of discourse that made him very unpopular with a large number of people. So I guess the question now is then, how much will things change? I think if Taves wins, the style of the party will change, but the ideology and the program won't change much. I've met Brian Jean in the past, and he's quite a likable person when you meet mm-hmm. him face to face, as a lot of politicians are. And I think he'll, a little more intuitively, Mr. Taves seems much more reserved. I've been close to him, but I haven't really had a conversation with him, right? So, but you know, there's lots of other people running too. And the latest entry today of Leela Ahir, who would be a red Tory and on the liberal side, such as it is of the UCP, who initially was made deputy leader by Kenny, and then she's been quite open about disagreeing with him. But there, I don't think the strategy, I suspect her strategy is not so much to represent the liberal side of the UCP as to save her own bacon politically, because in her own riding, she's under being pushed out by people loyal mm-hmm. to Mr. Kenny. I don't think the party establishment has settled on Travis Taves. And that's why people like Jason Nixon, for example, and possibly like Doug Schweitzer, who has already said he's not only not running for the leadership as a lot of people expected, but he's not even running again. But those red Tory, Schweitzer would be a red Tory type, but he's just out, right? Nixon has been really close to Kenny and again sees the world much the same way, but they obviously have set on Taves as a better bet, as somebody who can win the next election, not only win the leadership race.
Moving over to you, Carl, and Libby and David touched on this a bit, but so Jason Kenney was a key cabinet minister in Harper's government. Now, as Libby was mentioning, the conservative leadership is underway. What impact do you think the conservative race has had on the Canadian political scene? And for example, do you think it had any impact on the outcome of the Ontario election?
I'll just start the first part of the question first. And this leadership race, it's aroused a lot of interest among the minority of people who sympathized with the trucker convoys and who feel that political correctness and woke culture and giving in to Indigenous people and governments taking away our freedoms are all big problems, and that we should just pump our resources and we should have open, free, unregulated society, and governments shouldn't tell us to be vaccinated or any of that sort of nonsense. Those people are extremely excited by this. I mean, some of those people had been supporting Maxime Bernier and the People's Party of Canada. And those are an active and vocal group, and Pierre Poilievre has got those people very excited. He's also got people very worried. Pierre Poilievre both attracts very ardent supporters and scares a lot of people, and that's got people excited. So as we know by reading the press, they've sold a huge number of memberships, and there's big disputes among the leaders as to who sold more and who sold which. And they're getting a lot of people motivated and interested. In terms of Ontario, it should have been more related to Ontario in a way, because one of the candidates, Patrick Brown, is a former Ontario Conservative leader. A bunch of the candidates, including Pierre Poilievre, live in Ontario. Another candidate, Roman Baber, was a Doug Ford Conservative member of the legislature, who Doug Ford kicked out of his government because he refused to get vaccinated. So, but oddly, the Ontario Conservative just stayed away. They didn't want to talk about this at all. They didn't want to. Doug Ford wanted to campaign actually as Justin Trudeau's best friend and as a kind of manager of things and a builder of issues. I mean, Doug Ford, the one principle, deep-held principle, important political philosophy for him is that he loves cars and people who drive cars, and he's the guy who's going to help people who drive cars. Other than that, he pretty much doesn't believe in anything. He'll change. He started a government against rolling back a hike in the minimum wage. When people complained about it, he just reversed course. He's ready to change his mind and reverse course about pretty much anything, or seem to, or at least seem to do so. So the leadership race here at the level of the Conservatives will go on, and I think their provincial brethren are going to stay away. But we do have a group. We do have the very large possibility of a candidate who scares the mainstream business community in Canada, the sort of corporate conservative types. Pierre Poilievre, a guy who goes around saying he wants to fire the governor of the Bank of Canada and get involved in Bitcoin, scares the rock rib Bay Street business people. He scares their pants off. There's nothing totally wrong with disagreeing ever with a governor of the Bank of Canada, but Poilievre wants to get rid of the governor of the Bank of Canada just for no reason at all. Nobody can figure out what it is that he's done wrong. He's against institutions. Just like he used to attack the chief electoral officer. And he really, his kind of like bull in a china shop attitude. That's why a guy who was making more money in half a day than he'll make in a month as prime minister was ready to give it up to be prime minister. Because all this, that's Jean Charest, by the way. Jean Charest doesn't need this. He needs this like a hole in the head. He's had a long political career, and he's enormously successful as a corporate lawyer. But they came to him on hands and knees, and they said, "You gotta run. You gotta stop this guy." The business people of Canada. This is a conservative leadership candidate who scares the corporate community that has supported the Conservative Party for 50 years.
Carl, you'll recall that Mr. Kenney and Mr. Ford used to say that they could finish each other's sentences, but they're not doing that anymore.
Yeah. No, definitely not.
I guess I want to sort of shift the conversation a little bit, because I think what we're trying to get at here is watching these conservative leadership races go on federally and now in Alberta, plus the Ontario election, plus what's happening south of the border, where the politics is just so vitriolic and violent and hateful. I think what's really of interest to us and concerning us is how these issues are impacting Canadian politics and Canadian society. And I think the most disturbing development we're seeing in the Conservative leadership race is the rise of intolerance and hateful rhetoric from not all the candidates, but many of the candidates. And so, Rachel, to you, I'd like to bring you into the conversation. What impact do these emerging and strengthening, it appears, political right-wing forces have on Indigenous justice and land defense that really has grown remarkably, and yet here you are up against a pretty powerful movement also happening on the right. So what's the impact?
Well, I think especially in Alberta, we've already seen a bill put forward by Kenney's government right at the beginning of COVID, when we had people that were Indigenous people, First Nation people, who were actually sitting or standing in solidarity with the Wet'suwet'en and with their stand and trying to protect the land. And I think that Alberta has been very smart about getting the First Nations, especially in the northern areas. They've all sort of got them feeding into the corporate plan for Canada. So I don't think that we'd see a lot of protests there anyways. But there's other things happening, you know, such as, you know, the proposed mining and the things they want to do around the mountain areas, more privatizing of the parks and looking at the lakes and what they're doing to try to turn some of our sacred areas and our areas that are still unceded or not settled through a specific or a comprehensive lands claim process. Those types of things, I think, is where you might still see some action, despite the public safety bill or whatever Kenney put forward. I mean, he didn't even exercise it against, you know, when he had a convoy at the border. That was the time for him to put in his Emergency Measures Act or whatever it was he was doing, but he didn't do that. So I think that you're still going to see some pushback if the grassroots people are getting the proper information. And that, again, you know, that's up to the organizations where I work and where I'm writing with Rabble, and where I'm trying to work with Russ Dibo and with the Indigenous Activist Network. It's our job, or it's our responsibility, to try to break down some of the policies, legislation, the things that are happening within Canadian politics, within Alberta politics, how that affects legislation, and then further how that affects our First Nation people, the grassroots people on the ground. If you, again, I've explained this a few times, saying that Canadian mainstream media or Canadian media likes to look at is, they like to ask the chief and council, feeling that these are the duly elected representatives of a community. And I've repeatedly said, in our demographics, in our areas, in our reserves where we vote, we don't have platforms. You have clans and families voting. So you can have the same leadership spanning over a period of longer than, you know, 5-10 years. And if that's the case, then is this person really qualified to look at what's happening nationally, locally, regionally, nationally, internationally, and see the big picture and fight that fight? So it's still, for us, I think, at the grassroots level, it's still work. I mean, we still have to, continue to fight some of the, the only thing I keep thinking in my head is this cancel culture business that Kenny said when, after we found the graves, unmarked graves in Kamloops, he had come across, because we had, there was then a demand to rename buildings in Calgary. Statues were being torn down. But at the same time, he was saying it was cancel culture. And yet there aren't any monuments that show our contributions. So if there were things like that, then yes, I think it would be, he can make a cancel culture argument. Canadian society, Alberta society, or Alberta people have canceled First Nations. And when you do that and obliterate them, and have them have their perspective or their voices not being heard historically or in mainstream events, I think, you know, you've pretty well canceled their perspective or their opinion already. So then if it's only one perspective, then yes, we are going to make strong statements. And we look at it from our perspective as acts of protectionism and some of the things that we were told that we needed to do in order to keep our place and respect the land and help continue the way of life, not only for us, but what modern scientists, other people are finding now is living in harmony, living in balance. That is actually a better way, so that we can have life for all of us.
Yeah. So I'm gonna turn it back over to Robin, because I think that's a very good segue over to bringing Chuka into the conversation about how this is all playing out.
Yeah. It is, but before I get to that, let me just make a comment about this idea of cancel culture, right? Because that brings up this whole idea of the term thought police, right? Which suggests that the left somehow has police that run around. Let's remember, the right have police, right? Even the people on the right don't say the left have police. They say the left control the media and stuff. So let's just remember that, right? So Chuka, given the rise of the right and violent attacks in the U.S. and the apparent growing strength of right-wing politics in Canada, should activists focus their attention on combating the right wing or ignore it and focus on the solutions to the many other pressing problems we face? So we'll start with Chuka, but let's hear from everybody on that.
I can't rightly say what activists should do, but I certainly don't think that the issues can be separated. And I can explain why. Just to refer back to what you were discussing a moment ago, Libby, about the impact of US politics on what's happening in Canadian politics now, I think that there are a couple things that that can be identified as potentially sort of spilling between the two. In one of the leadership, in one of the debates for the Federal Conservative Party leadership, only Leslyn Lewis on stage, Leslyn Lewis was the only candidate who who advocated against abortion access, or stated that she was against people accessing abortion, or personally against it, what have you, and it got significant applause from the crowd. And of course, we're seeing a horrifically revanchist attack on the rights of women and other people, and people can become pregnant in the U.S. And you know, I think there's concern that that's emboldening people on the right in Canada. Similarly, just earlier today, I saw a headline about I haven't dug into this yet, but there was legislation passed in regarding the Dakota Access Pipeline that asserts that any sort of attempt to interfere with its development or operation is now considered, under this legislation, would be considered terrorism, and anyone charged with that is susceptible to potentially 10 years incarcerated. So, I mean, I don't think that, you know, separating take for example the Dakota Access Pipeline, that is of course an issue of environmentalism, but of course it's also an issue of entrenched poverty, it's also an issue of racism. So I think that the way that these issues are connected means that you can, in addressing one, you sort of have to fundamentally address another. An example, I think a significant example of this, is the Black Panthers breakfast survival programs. The programs were, they spanned a number of sectors, right? There were, free medical services and resources. There was education. There was breakfast run for the community. All of these things are, you know, one is dealing with medical inequity. One is sort of dealing with educational inequity. But all of them, of course, are also measures of anti-racism, in that they're addressing inequities that are disproportionately borne by particular communities. So I think that if you are sort of seeking to address or eliminate inequity in housing, in economic security, and access to any number of institutions or services, then the people who are disproportionately prohibited from that access are always going to be racialized populations and marginalized groups. And so in attempting to address those issues, those pressing issues that you mentioned, Robin, I think you are necessarily also opposing the right. But I do think that, I don't know, this is a point we can return to, but I think as well, though, that there will come a time in the near future where we'll have to start simply just like building the world that we want to see and providing the lives for people that we want, that lives that are sort of free from the violence that is increasingly being advocated and enacted by the right, but also free from the violence that is entrenched in the society that we all inhabit.
That was a segment from our latest Off the Hill political panel, Hot Summer in the West. Thank you to our special guests, Rachel Snow, David Kleimenhage, Chuka Ejekum, Carl Narenberg, and hosts Robin Brown and Libby Davies. And thank you to all who attended the Zoom webinar. Now it's time for a segment we like to call In Case You Missed It. And for that, I'll hand it over to the editor of Rabble.ca, Nick Seabrook. Over to you, Nick.
Thanks, Brianne. This week on Rabble.ca, Stephen Wentzel shared the Native Women's Association of Canada's scorecard on the federal government's progress with the 231 calls for justice presented by the National Inquiry into Missing, Murdered Indigenous Women and Girls. The report sadly found little to no progress has been made since the federal government introduced the plan a year ago. Native Women's Association of Canada CEO Lynn Grew said the National Action Plan as it was drafted was actually a recipe for inaction, and the people represented by our organization are paying the price. Wary of the plan from the beginning, the organization has dismissed the National Action Plan as an aspirational document with no funding, timelines, or measurable goals. Meanwhile, the Native Women's Association of Canada has released an action plan of their own titled Our Calls, Our Action. According to the organization, 40 of its 66 action steps have been fully completed, with progress being made on an additional 18. In labor news, Gabriella Kaluga-Kasuga reported on a rally the Public Service Alliance of Canada, commonly known as PSAC, held in the lobby of the Treasury Board of Canada in Ottawa on Wednesday, June 8th. While not yet on strike, PSAC is engaged in a labor dispute with the Treasury Board over wages and unfulfilled promises of anti-racism training in the workplace. PSAC had originally broken off negotiations with the Treasury Board on May 18th and filed a motion for conciliation. Alex Silas, the PSAC Regional Executive Vice President for the National Capital Region, promised that Wednesday's rally was just the beginning of the work actions being considered by the union. Silas said, "We're showing the employer today with actions that will be happening over the next month that PSAC's members are organized, mobilized, and ready to fight for a fair contract. We are ready to take the fight as far as we need to take it, up to and including a strike. We hope to avoid a strike, but that is in the employer's hands." Also this week, Rabble reported on the Council of Canadians Community Solidarity Project. The project's goal is combating divisive politics and hate in communities, and was created in response to the occupation of the nation's capital back in February by the so-called Freedom Convoy. The chair of the Council of Canadians, John Cartwright, believes that the lack of police action early on in the protest made them complicit with the convoy and their supporters. This inspired the organization to create the Community Solidarity Project, to provide communities with the tools and resources needed to protect and support themselves in case of another hate-filled convoy-like occupation. The project also aims at helping individuals connect with neighbors, friends, or family members who may have fallen down rabbit holes of misinformation or have embraced extremist views. The Community Solidarity Project has received support from over a dozen Canadian labor unions and nonprofit entities, including QP Ontario, the Broadbent Institute, Acorn Canada, the Canadian Anti-Hate Network, and more. Finally, in environmental news, Doreen Nickel encourages you to take action for ocean eco-justice. Wednesday, June 8 was World Oceans Day. Doreen Nickel spoke to Stand.Earth, a nonprofit environmental organization which has been calling for an end to cruise ship waste dumping on BC's coastline. Turns out BC is unequivocally the toilet bowl of the West Coast, Anna Barford of Stand.Earth told Rabble. For too long, Transport Canada has been letting industry put profit ahead of community and pollution prevention. We don't want this here. We have a thriving ocean economy, and that's what we need to protect. That means closing the toilet bowl. Stand.Earth is calling for a ban on cruise ship bunker oil, pushing for stronger regulations and enforcement of anti-dumping laws, and advocating for an urgent shift away from fossil fuels to cleaner power sources instead. You can catch all of those stories and much, much more on rabble.ca.
Thanks a lot, Nick. And that's it for Rabble Radio this week. Thanks as always for tuning in. If you like the show, please consider subscribing to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And please rate, review, share Rabble Radio with your friends. It takes 2 seconds to support independent media like Rabble. If you have feedback for the show, ideas, stories, opinions you'd like us to cover, we'd love to hear about it. Get in touch with us anytime at editor@rabble.ca. Thank you to all the journalists and writers who contributed to this week's content on rabble.ca, and thank you to Carl Nirenberg for supplying the music. And lastly, thank you to you for tuning in to Rabble Radio. I'm Brianne Doyle, and I'll talk to you next week.